adverse effect on the future contracting or exploitation of specialists, and will only serve as another example of broken faith on the part of the United States. The CIC officer felt that when considering the magnitude of Schieber's potential value to the United States, either for military or civil exploitation, it was obvious that his contract needed to be honored one way or other. The officer recommended that Schieber be paid as a consultant to the U.S. Army in Heidelberg. In the meantime, he could appeal the judgment of the Spruckhammern trial and become part of Project Paperclip after the attention died down. The Air Force had already soured on Schieber. At the Pentagon, his case had been reviewed again. The Air Force now saw Schieber's Nazi Party history in a wholly different light. In their eyes, Schieber had transformed from a brilliant engineer to a ruthless, greedy war profiteer. Walter Schieber started his business career at the Güstlaufwerk in Weimar, a combine owned by the Nazi Party and comprising five industrial corporations, read the Air Force response. He soon became the leader in the German cellulose and rayon ring, which was the second largest fiber combine in Germany. He founded Thuringisch Zellwohl AG in Schwarz and subsequently gained control of the French synthetic fiber combine, meaning that with the help of SS officers, Schieber had confiscated Jewish-owned businesses in France and made them the property of the Third Reich. Synthetic fibers were imperative to the Reich, used for everything from soldiers' uniforms to blankets to parachutes. Photographs of Schieber displaying bolts of synthetic cloth to Hitler, Himmler, and Bormann show all parties smiling with pride. Schieber was appointed by Speer to the position of Chief of the Office for Delivery of Armament Goods in the Ministry for Armaments and Munitions, and was named deputy leader of the National Group Industry by Walter Funk, read the Air Force report. How he went from dealing fabrics to weapons production remained unclear, but his ambition had to have come into play. Described as a top-ranking figure in the Nazi war economy, he is said to have constantly profited from being a party man, noted the Air Force. There was only one conclusion. Cancel Air Force request for Walter Schieber. Subject considered ineligible paperclip. United States European Command, UCOM, headquarters in Frankfurt, various commands had different headquarters, cabled the JOA office at the Pentagon to let them know that cancellation of the request was an unsound idea. It is believed here that these considerations outweigh the risk of possible criticism of his being sent to the United States, and if necessary, warrant an exception to present policy. Further, it is considered advisable that for Schieber's future personal safety and for intelligence reasons, he not be present when and if official action against him occurs. Therefore, it is strongly recommended that reconsideration be given the decision to cancel Schieber's contract, and that he be sent to the United States, regardless of the outcome of his appeal. UCOM wanted Schieber moved out of Germany and sent to the United States now. Nothing happened for 3 months, until Brigadier General Charles Lukes arrived in Heidelberg. After the second Schieber call came in to General Lukes's office, Lukes told his lieutenant to set up a meeting with the man. As of 2013, their official meeting remains classified. But General Lukes wrote regularly in his desk diary, which fills in what the declassified Operation Paperclip case file on Schieber leaves out. On October 14, 1948, Dr. Schieber was invited to attend a roundtable conference at Army Chemical Corps headquarters in Heidelberg. Classified matters were discussed, Lukes penned in his journal that night. Schieber told Lukes that he had been in on the Reich's manufacturing of nerve gas from the beginning. He appealed to General Lukes's patriotic side. I want you to know that if there is anything I can do to help the West, I shall do it, Schieber said. Lukes liked Schieber's willingness to help the cause so much that he invited Schieber to join him at his house for a drink. That evening, Lukes recorded his thoughts. Attended conference with Dr. Walter Schieber, classified matters. No particular info, but hope for more later, possibly when better acquainted. I'll try to see him next time he reports in to Division of Intelligence. He directed the production of war gases on a rather high echelon, so doesn't have the detailed knowledge that I want. But possibly I can get the names of useful people from him. Took him to the house for a drink. Chemical weapons, like biological weapons, were perceived by some to be dirty business, as President Roosevelt once said. But to men like General Lukes and Walter Schieber, to advance a nation's arsenal of chemical weapons was a challenging and necessary job. It was more interesting than going down to Paris on weekends, Lukes wrote in his journal. General Lukes asked to meet with Dr. Schieber again, this time to ask Schieber if he could assist with a problem the U.S. Army was having producing sarin gas. Schieber was happy to help. He told Lukes that during the war, it was the Farben chemists who had produced sarin gas, and that he knew all these chemists very well. They were his friends. They worked with me during the war, Schieber explained. We wouldn't expect you to do this for free, Lukes told Schieber, meaning provide the U.S. Chemical Corps with secrets. The two men arranged to meet again in the following weeks. On October 28, 1948, Lukes and his wife Pearl hosted a dinner party in their home. Again, Schieber was a guest. Lukes had by now taken an extraordinary liking to Dr. Schieber, and he wrote his impressions of the man in his diary that night. Schieber is interesting, an independent, thinking, intelligent, and very competent man. He related much of his experience with the Russians, a prisoner of war after the First World War for a year. He was an honorary brigade Führer of SS this last war, in confinement in Nuremberg for 7 months. Quartered next to Göring until the latter killed himself. Was an admirer of Todt, later worked for Speer, was directed to report to Hitler frequently. He has many anecdotes and is a loyal German. Is willing to do anything for the future of the world and Germany. Why was General Lukes so willing to overlook SS Brigade Führer Dr. Walter Schieber's criminal past and his central role inside the Third Reich? A story that Charles Lukes told an army historian decades later sheds light on this question. At the end of World War II, after the Japanese surrendered, Colonel Lukes went to Tokyo, where he served as the chief chemical officer for the U.S. Army. Sometimes Lukes took day trips into the countryside. In the last 5 months of war in Japan, American bombers conducted a massive incendiary bombing campaign against 67 Japanese cities that killed nearly 1 million citizens, most of whom burned to death. Still, the Japanese refused to surrender, and it took 2 atomic bombs to end the war. The incendiary bombs dropped on those 67 cities were produced at the Rocky Mountain Arsenal. Colonel Lukes oversaw the production of tens of thousands of them. In Japan, after the fighting was over, and when Lukes took day trips, he often brought his camera along and took photographs of the landscape, the damage, and the dead. When Lukes returned home to America, he compiled these photographs into an album of more than 100 black-and-white snapshots. One photograph in the album, which is archived at the U.S. Army Heritage Center in Pennsylvania, shows Colonel Lukes standing next to an enormous pile of dead bodies. Years later, Colonel Lukes explained to the Army historian what the photograph meant to him. Driving one day in a jeep from Yokohama to Tokyo, I stopped along the side of a road. The incendiary attacks had done their work, Lukes explained. The area was all burned out, a wasteland all the way through. We dropped tens of thousands of them, incendiary bombs, on the whole area between Yokohama and Tokyo. Out there in the Japanese countryside, said Lukes, I noticed a great stack of incendiary bombs, small ones. I went over to take a look at them. They looked like something we had made at Rocky Mountain. Sure enough, they were. Here in one place, they had a great stack of them. They were burned out, but the bodies were still there because they didn't burn. They stacked them up in this big high pile. I had a picture of me standing beside them, because I had been responsible for the manufacturing of them. This was just one of those incidents that didn't mean anything, but I just happened to see what had happened to some of our incendiary bombs that were over there. In describing the photograph, an enormous pile of dead bodies next to a stack of incendiary bombs, Colonel Lukes expressed a peculiar kind of detachment. To the Army historian interviewing him, Lukes made clear that what interested him in the photograph was noting the effectiveness, or in this case, ineffectiveness, of the bombs he had been responsible for manufacturing. Similarly, Lukes expressed detachment as far as Dr. Schieber was concerned, as evidenced in his journal entries. It was as if Lukes could not, or would not, see Schieber in the context of the millions of Jews murdered on the direct orders of Schieber's closest wartime colleagues. What interested Lukes about Schieber was what an effective chemical weapons maker he was. During the next meeting between General Lukes and Dr. Schieber, Lukes got very specific with Schieber in terms of what he was after. Could you develop the process and put it on paper with drawings, specifications, and tables, and safety regulations to make sarin? Lukes asked, as noted in his desk diary. Yes, I could do that, Schieber said. Lukes recalled the next conversation the two men had. He said they had a big works outside of Berlin that was just completed when the war was over and made little token amounts but no production. When the Reich announced that the Russians were taking over, those engineers and chemists both came west into the American and British occupied zones. Schieber was lying to General Lukes. The nerve gas production plant outside Berlin to which Schieber referred was Falkenhagen, and it was run by Otto Ambrose's deputy and the man who had stashed the steel drum outside Gindorf, Jürgen von Klink. By war's end, the factory at Falkenhagen had produced more than 500 tons of sarin gas, hardly little token amounts, as Schieber claimed. If Lukes had read von Klink's Omgus security report, or any of the SIOS reports written by Major Edmund Tilley, he would have learned that Schieber was lying to him. Instead, General Lukes asked Schieber if he could locate these chemists who knew so much about sarin production and bring them to Heidelberg. He held out to Schieber the promise of a U.S. Army contract. Further, we will pay all their, the chemists, expenses and give them something for their work, Lukes said. Yes, I can do that, Schieber replied. He said that he knew all of the Farben chemists and could easily get them to tell the Americans everything. He listed their names for Lukes. One of the six Farben chemists on the list was Ambrose's deputy and the man who ran Falkenhagen, Jürgen von Klink. On October 29, 1948, Colonel Lukes wrote a memorandum to the chief of the Army Chemical Corps. The best, fastest way to get German technical information on Tabin and sarin gas was to hire Dr. Schieber, Colonel Lukes advised. In his diary, Lukes wrote, Hope the chief will support us. If he does, we'll be able to get all of the German CW technical ability on our side and promptly. They know on what side they belong. All we need to do is treat them as human beings. They recognize the military defeat and the political and ideological defeat as well and accept it. 1 week later, General Lukes told Schieber that he had been authorized to pay him 1,000 marks a month for consulting work. Schieber gave Lukes the contact information for the 6 chemists and technicians who would join him in his efforts to explain precisely how to produce sarin gas. On December 11, 1948, Lukes hosted the first roundtable meeting of Hitler's chemists in his Heidelberg home, secrecy assured. For the next 3 months, the chemists met every other Saturday at Lukes's home. There, they created detailed, step-by-step reports on how to produce industrial amounts of sarin gas. They drew charts and graphs and made lists of materials and equipment required. Years later, Lukes reflected, one of the team members was a young engineer who had an excellent command of English, which helped greatly and was his major contribution, and that was Jürgen von Klink. When the work was finally compiled and sent to Edgewood, the results were the perfect recipe for the deadly nerve agent. According to General Lukes, without Hitler's chemists, the American program had been a failure. With them, it was a success. "That's when we built the plant out in Rocky Mountain Arsenal," Lukes explained. The incendiary bombs that Colonel Lukes oversaw at Rocky Mountain Arsenal during World War II would now be replaced by M-34 cluster bombs filled with sarin gas. The top-secret program was codenamed Gibbet Delivery. A friendship between two brigadier generals, Lukes and Schieber, had been solidified. The following summer, Schieber sent Lukes a thank you note and a gift, not identified in the records, but described by Schieber as a piece of equipment that once stood at the beginning of the same work group. The unknown item had been used by Schieber during the Nazi era, when sarin gas was first developed for Hitler. Over the next 8 years, the two brigadier generals exchanged Christmas cards. In January 1950, General Lukes was called to Washington, D.C., for several meetings at the Pentagon. According to Lukes's desk diary, during his first meeting there, he was reprimanded by a Pentagon official for cultivating friendly relationships with Hitler's chemists. "I don't like this," Lukes wrote that his superior had informed him. "I don't want to be made a fool of over this. Everyone seems to have cut them, the Nazis, off their list. To be friendly with them seems bad form." But General Lukes noted in his diary that he had every intention of defying the superior's request. He had become good friends with the German chemists. He regularly had meals with Walter Schieber and Richard Kuhn, and on at least one occasion, Schieber had spent the night at Lukes's house. "I'll see them anyhow," he wrote in a diary entry dated February 1, 1950. The following day, Lukes was called back into the Pentagon. "Went to Pentagon," he wrote. "Long session with HQ Int, Headquarters Intelligence. People seemed interested in what we are doing in Heidelberg. Would give me money necessary to exploit the Germans for scientific and technical intelligence." In other words, what some at the Pentagon refused to condone, others were willing to support through covert means. General Lukes's secret Saturday roundtable at his house in Heidelberg with the Nazi chemists remained hidden from the public for 6 decades. Here was a brigadier general with the U.S. Army doing business with a former brigadier general of the Third Reich, allegedly in the interests of the United States. It was a Cold War black program that was paid for by the U.S. Army, but did not officially exist. There were no checks and no balances. Operation Paperclip was becoming a headless monster. The CIA's working relationship with the JOA and Operation Paperclip had begun within a few months of the agency's creation. Within the CIA, Paperclip was managed inside the Office of Collection and Dissemination, and one of the first things requested by its administrator, L.T. Shannon, was a photostated copy of a set of files compiled by Dr. Werner Aussenberg and consisting of biographical records of approximately 18,000 German scientists. By the winter of 1948, hundreds of memos were going back and forth between the JOA and the CIA. Sometimes the CIA would request information from the JOA on certain scientists, and sometimes the JOA would ask the CIA to provide it with intelligence on a specific scientist or group of scientists. Also, in the first 3 months of the CIA's existence, the National Security Council issued Directive No. 3, dealing specifically with the production of intelligence and the coordination of intelligence production activities within the intelligence community. The National Security Council wanted to know who was producing what intelligence and how that information was being coordinated among agencies. In the opinion of the CIA, the link between scientific planning and military research on a national scale did not hitherto exist. The result was the creation of the Scientific Intelligence Committee, SIC, chaired by the CIA and with members from the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the State Department, and the Atomic Energy Commission. Very early in its existence, the SIC undertook to define scientific intelligence, delineate areas of particular interest, and establish committees to handle these areas, wrote SIC Chairman Dr. Carl Weber in a CIA monograph that remained classified until September 2008. Priority was accorded to atomic energy, biological warfare, chemical warfare, electronic warfare, guided missiles, aircraft, undersea warfare, and medicine, every area involving Operation Paperclip scientists. 8 scientific intelligence subcommittees were created, one for each area of warfare. Despite the urgency, the JOA's plan to make Operation Paperclip over into a long-term program was still at a standstill. By the spring of 1948, half of the 1,000 German scientists bound for America had arrived, but not a single one of them had a visa. Troublemaker Samuel Klaus was gone from the State Department, but the JOA could still not get the visa division to make things happen fast enough. On May 11, 1948, Military Intelligence Chief General Stephen J. Chamberlain, the man who had briefed Eisenhower in 1947, took matters into his own hands. Chamberlain went to meet FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover to enlist his help with visas. Cold War paranoia was on the rise, and both men were staunch anti-communists. The success of Operation Paperclip, said Chamberlain, was essential to national security. The FBI had the communists to fear, not the Nazis. Hoover agreed. Paperclip recruits needed the promise of American citizenship now more than ever, Chamberlain said, before any more of them were stolen away by the Russians. Chamberlain asked Hoover to put pressure on the State Department. J. Edgar Hoover said he would see what he could do. What, if anything, Hoover did remains a mystery. 3 months later, the first 7 scientists had U.S. immigrant visas. Now it was time to put the transition process to the test. For Operation Paperclip, moving a scientist from military custody to immigrant status required elaborate and devious preparation, but in the end, the procedure proved to be infallible. Scientists in the southwestern or western United States, accompanied by military escort, were driven in an unmarked army jeep out of the country into Mexico, either at Nuevo Laredo, Ciudad Juarez, or Tijuana. With him, each scientist carried 2 forms from the State Department, I-55 and I-255, each bearing a signature from the chief of the visa division and a proviso from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Section 42.323 of Title 22, signifying that the visa holder was a person whose admission is highly desirable in the national interest. The scientist also had with him a photograph of himself and a blood test warranting that he did not have any infectious diseases. After consulate approval, the scientist was then let back into the United States, no longer under military guard, but as a legal U.S. immigrant in possession of a legal visa. The pathway toward citizenship had begun. If the scientist lived closer to the East Coast than the West Coast, he went through the same protocols, except that he would exit the United States into Canada instead of Mexico and re-enter through the consulate at Niagara Falls. It was an international crisis in June of 1948 that finally gave Operation Paperclip its long-term momentum. Early on the morning of June 24th, the Soviets cut off all land and rail access to the American zone in Berlin. This action would become known as the Berlin Blockade, and it was seen as one of the first major international crises of the Cold War. The Soviet blockade of Berlin in 1948 clearly indicated that the wartime alliance between the Soviets and the United States had dissolved, explained CIA Deputy Director for Operations Jack Downing. Germany then became a new battlefield between East and West. The CIA presence in Germany was redoubled, and its plans for covert action against the Soviets shifted into high gear. The CIA needed to hire thousands of foreign nationals living in Germany to help in this effort, spies, saboteurs, and scientists, many of whom had spent time in displaced person camps and interrogation facilities operated by the U.S. Army in the American zone of occupied Germany. Initially, the CIA and the JOA worked hand in glove inside Germany to thwart Soviet threats, but soon the two agencies would start competing for German scientists and spies. The two agencies worked together inside a clandestine intelligence facility in the American zone, informally called Camp King. The activities there between 1946 and the late 1950s have never been fully accounted for by either the Department of Defense or the CIA. Camp King was strategically located in the village of Oberursel, just 11 miles northwest of the United States European Command, UCOM, headquarters in Frankfurt. Officially, the facility had two other names: the U.S. Military Intelligence Service Center at Oberursel, and the 7707th European Command Intelligence Center. A small plaque in a park outside the Officers' Club explained to visitors the significance of the informal name. Colonel Charles B. King, an intelligence officer, had been in the process of accepting the surrender of a group of Nazis on Utah Beach in June 1944, when he was double-crossed and slain by a strong and concentrated barrage of enemy artillery fire. There was tragic irony in the name. Camp King had become home to many well-intentioned American officers trying to make deals with untrustworthy enemies. Many of these American officers would be double-crossed, and at least one of them would be killed. A lot had changed at Camp King since John Dolabois had personally delivered 6 Nazi bombs in here in August 1945. The interrogation facility had become one of the most clandestine U.S. intelligence centers in Western Europe, and for more than a decade it would function as a Cold War black site long before black sites were known as such. Camp King was a joint interrogation center, and the intelligence agencies that shared access to prisoners here included Army Intelligence, Air Force Intelligence, Naval Intelligence, and the CIA. By 1948, most of its prisoners were Soviet bloc spies. How the CIA used Camp King remains one of the agency's most closely guarded secrets. It was here in Oberursel that the CIA first began developing extreme interrogation techniques and behavior modification programs under the code names Operation Bluebird and Operation Artichoke. The unorthodox methods the CIA and its partner agencies explored included hypnosis, electric shock, chemicals, and illegal street drugs. Camp King was chosen as an ideal place to do this work, in part because it was off-site, but mainly because of its access to prisoners believed to be Soviet spies. When the Americans captured the facility in the spring of 1945, the Nazis had been using it as an interrogation facility for Allied flyers. Camp King's first commanding officer was Colonel William Russell Philp, and through the fall of 1945, Philp shared the Military Intelligence Service Center at Oberursel with General William J. Donovan, founding director of the Office of Strategic Services. General Donovan oversaw an operation here whereby high-ranking Nazi generals, including those dropped off by John Dollebois, were paid to write intelligence reports on subjects like German order of battle and Nazi Party chain of command. Dollebois, fluent in German, acted as Donovan's liaison to the Nazi prisoners during this time. General Donovan kept an office at Oberursel until the OSS was disbanded in September 1945, after which he returned to Washington, D.C. and civilian life. Colonel Philp's job was to handle the rest of the prisoners. In the months that followed war's end, the Camp King prison population grew to include Russian defectors and captured Soviet spies. There was valuable intelligence to be gained from these individuals, Philp learned, willingly or through coercion. But Philp also found that his officers lacked a greater context within which to interpret the raw intelligence being gathered from the Soviets. Russia had been America's ally during the war. Now it was the enemy. The Soviets were masters of disinformation. Who was telling the truth? The Nazi prisoners claimed to know, and Colonel Philp began using several of them to interpret and analyze information from Soviet defectors. These Nazis were experts in espionage against the Russians, Philp later said. Two of them seemed particularly knowledgeable. Gerhard Wessel, who had been an officer in the German intelligence organization, Abwehr, and Wessel's deputy, Hermann Baun. Philp put the men to work. What started out as a research project using POWs became a gradual drift into operations, said Philp. He moved the Nazis into a safe house on the outskirts of Camp King, codenamed House Blue, where they oversaw counterintelligence operations against the Soviets under the codename Project Keystone. Philp found that working with Nazis was a slippery slope, and in a matter of months, the Germans had transformed from prisoners to paid intelligence assets of the U.S. Army. In the summer of 1946, a major event occurred that influenced the CIA's future role in Operation Paperclip and Camp King. Major General Reinhard Gehlen, former head of the Nazis' intelligence operation against the Soviets, arrived at Camp King. Gehlen had been in the United States under interrogation since 1945. Here at Oberursel, Army intelligence decided to make Gehlen head of its entire anti-communist intelligence organization under the codename Operation Rusty. Eventually, the organization would become known simply as the Gehlen Organization, a network of former Nazi intelligence agents, the majority of whom were members of the SS, began working out of offices at Camp King, side by side with Army intelligence officers. Colonel Philp was in charge of overall supervision. By late 1947, the Galen organization had gotten so large it required its own headquarters. Army intelligence moved the organization to a self-contained facility outside Munich in a village called Pulla. This compound was the former estate of Martin Bormann and had large grounds, sculpture gardens, and a pool. The two facilities, at Oberursel and Pola, worked together. Galen and Baun claimed to have 600 intelligence agents, all former Nazis, in the Soviet zone of occupied Germany alone. According to documents kept classified for 51 years, relations between Galen and Philp declined and became hostile, as Philp finally realized the true nature of who he was dealing with. The Galen organization was a murderous bunch, freewheeling and out of control. As one CIA affiliate observed, "American intelligence is a rich blind man using the Abwehr as a seeing eye dog. The only trouble is the leash is much too long." The army became fed up with the Galen organization, but there was no way out. Its operatives were professional double-crossers and liars. Many were also alleged war criminals, and now they had the army over a barrel. Decades later, it would emerge that General Galen was reportedly earning $1 million a year. In late 1948, CIA Director Roscoe Hillenkoetter met with Army Intelligence to discuss the CIA's taking charge of the Galen organization. The two parties agreed, and on July 1, 1945, the CIA officially assumed control of Galen and his men. That same summer, the CIA created the Office of Scientific Intelligence, OSI, and its first director, Dr. Willard Marshall, traveled to Germany to set up a program for special interrogation methods against Soviet spies. The CIA had intelligence indicating that the Soviets had developed mind control programs. The agency wanted to know what it would be up against if the Russians got hold of its American spies. In an attempt to determine what kinds of techniques the Soviets might be using, the CIA set up a top-secret interrogation program at Camp King. The facility offered unique access to Soviet spies who had been caught in the Galen organization's web. Revolutionary new interrogation techniques could be practiced on these men under the operational code name Bluebird. A limited number of official CIA documents remain on record from this program. Most were destroyed by CIA Director Richard Helms. Initially, the CIA envisioned Operation Bluebird as a defensive program. Officers from scientific intelligence were to apply special methods of interrogation for the purpose of evaluation of Russian practices. But very quickly, the agency decided that in order to master the best defensive methods, it needed to first develop the most cutting-edge offensive techniques. This sounded like doublespeak and was indicative of the Cold War mindset that was taking hold in intelligence circles and also in the military. The CIA believed it needed to develop the sharpest sword to create the strongest, most impenetrable shield. Operation Bluebird was just the beginning. Soon the program would expand to include mind control techniques and Nazi doctors recruited under Operation Paperclip. Chapter 17, Hall of Mirrors. In the fall of 1948 in Germany, one of the most unusual press conferences of the Cold War took place. Major General Walter Schreiber, the former Surgeon General of the Third Reich, had last been seen on the stand at Nuremberg testifying against fellow members of the Nazi High Command. Then, on November 2, 1948, he reappeared at a press conference. After 3 years, 5 months, and 3 days in Soviet custody, Schreiber had allegedly escaped from his Soviet captors. Now, the vaccine specialist said he had important news to share with the free world. The press conference opened with Schreiber delivering a brief statement about what had happened to him. He'd been a prisoner of the Soviets since the fall of Berlin and had recently escaped, followed by a lengthy question-and-answer period with an American official acting as translator. The first question asked by a reporter was, "How did Schreiber manage to escape?" Schreiber said he had broken free of his communist guards in a life-or-death situation, but hesitated to say more. With him now, in the safety of U.S. protective custody, he said, were his wife, Olga, his 14-year-old son, Paul Gerhard, and one of his two grown daughters. "How was it possible the Russians let him get out?" asked another member of the press, a question on everyone's mind. In the 2 years since General Schreiber's stunning testimony at Nuremberg, he'd been made a starshina, or elder, in the Soviet military. It was almost inconceivable that a major player like Schreiber simply slipped away from his Soviet guards. Yet here he was. "I'm not asking the details," the reporter clarified, "but how was it possible he was able to escape?" In November 1948, Berlin was a city under psychological and physical siege. For more than 4 months now, the Soviets had blocked all rail, canal, and road access between East and West Berlin. To feed the civilians in the Western Zone, the Americans were flying in airplanes full of food. Schreiber's escape happened during the height of the Berlin blockade. "For security reasons, I would not like to answer this question," Schreiber said. "I don't want to ask any details," repeated the newsman. "But is it possible for others who are in the same position to get out?" "The question was answered," said Schreiber. Pressed further, Major General Dr. Schreiber reconstructed some of the events in his tale of escape. He'd been in Soviet Russia until the summer, he said. There, he and a group of other former Nazi generals lived together in a villa outside Berlin. In July or August, six of the generals, including Schreiber, were unexpectedly transported to a country house on the German-Polish border, near Frankfurt on the Oder, east of Berlin, not to be confused with Frankfurt on the Main, located in the American zone, southwest of Berlin. With regard to this mysterious journey and its greater purpose, Major General Schreiber said, "We were not asked, but we were told that we were going to join the police." Only then, Schreiber explained, did he learn that he had been appointed chief medical officer for the newly formed East German police. Schreiber said he was offered food, clothing, housing, furniture, four advantages. Four of the Nazi generals agreed to take the job. Schreiber said he objected. He was a scientist, not a policeman, he claimed to have told his Soviet handlers. The group of generals was transported to a home in Saxony, close to the Czechoslovakian border. Finally, the last day of September, the four generals who had agreed were sent to Berlin in order to start their jobs, Schreiber said. He and another general, who had by this time also voiced objection, remained guarded by police. 2 days later, Schreiber was sent to Dresden in the Soviet zone. "There, we were very well received, and I was offered the chance to become professor at the University of Leipzig," Schreiber told the press corps. "I demanded the University of Berlin. I had special reason for this demand. That was denied of me. For this reason, I made myself free." So that was that. A chorus of West German reporters wanted more details. How does one simply make oneself free of Soviet military police, especially if one is the former Surgeon General of the Third Reich? For the Soviets, turning high-ranking Nazi generals into communist officials was an immense propaganda coup in the early days of the Cold War. One had to assume that Soviet military intelligence, Glavnoye Razvidovaknoye Upravyenie, or GRU, was keeping a watchful eye on each of the generals through their transition from Soviet Russia into the East German zone. The GRU's notorious official emblem featured an omnipotent bat hovering over the globe. The GRU kept radar-like track of people. They had eyes in the night. To allow Dr. Schreiber to get away sounded implausible. I took off alone by express train on the railroad from Dresden to Berlin, and it was a trip of life and death, Schreiber said. And that was all he was going to say about it. Next, Schreiber began to lecture his audience on the Soviet threat. He singled out a former colleague, Vincenz Müller, to blame, not unlike what he had done with Dr. Blomup before the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg. Lieutenant General Vincenz Müller was a dangerous man, exclaimed Schreiber. Now that he'd gone over to the Russian side, he was a threat to world peace. Lieutenant General Müller had recently been installed by the Soviet government as the new police leader in Berlin, Schreiber said. He is a fanatical communist, promised Schreiber, completely devoted to the Russians. This is all the more astonishing, as Müller comes from a very devout Catholic family. The Russians had plans to arm Müller's new Berlin police force with heavy weapons, tanks, and artillery. The Soviets had only one goal, Schreiber promised, and that was world domination. It was beginning right now with the rearmament of East Berlin. Can you give us the names of the four other generals outside of General Vincenz Müller? A news reporter asked. I don't think it is necessary in the scope of this press conference to give those names, said Schreiber. Could the Russians be selling you a bill of goods? Asked another reporter. The Russians are animated by the idea of world revolution, Schreiber said. He explained that in Russia, most people believe the revolution is coming. Another news reporter asked, Were you wearing your Soviet uniform when you escaped? It was a good question. If Schreiber had been wearing his Soviet uniform, then clearly he would have been noticed by border patrol guards, stopped, and questioned as he passed from the Soviet zone to the American zone of occupation. If Schreiber had not been wearing his Soviet uniform, then the obvious next question was, why not? Schreiber's answer was convoluted. His Soviet uniform happened to be at the tailor shop on the day of his escape, he said, getting new shoulder straps and embroidery on the collar. To emphasize his point, Schreiber even went so far as to recreate a conversation between himself and his Soviet handler, a man named Fischer, regarding the missing uniform. Fischer said to me, "You are going to get your uniform later. For the time being, this is not yet possible." The explanation seemed implausible to at least one newsman. Why didn't you get your uniform tailored earlier? The reporter asked. Schreiber said that his measurements had been taken for the new uniform, but the tailoring was delayed. When Schreiber's American handler moved to change the subject, another reporter asked for more information about the human experiments Dr. Schreiber had spoken of during the Nuremberg trial. How did the doctor obtain knowledge of experiments on human beings? He queried. Schreiber insisted he had never taken part in any such research work. The knowledge I gained about it, I either gained through documents I ran across in my position or in medical conventions where intellectuals could see that something like that was being conducted in the background. Every aspect of Schreiber's escape story seemed unreasonable, which made it difficult for the reporters to take seriously almost anything else he said. Yet the press conference went on for more than 30 minutes, with Schreiber standing his ground. As it turned out, Schreiber's press conference was not impromptu, but rehearsed. He had been discussing his testimony with officers from the U.S. Counterintelligence Corps for 2 weeks, since October 18, 1948, the day he walked into the CIC's Berlin office. CIC Special Agent Severine Wallach was Schreiber's handler. Wallach had heard a much longer version of what had allegedly been going on with Schreiber since his capture by the Red Army during the fall of Berlin. According to the 13-page report by Wallach in Schreiber's intelligence dossier, on the 5th of May, Dr. Schreiber was sent, together with other captured German generals, back to Berlin. The generals were put in a cellar of the Reich Chancellery in Berlin and received orders to emerge from this cellar under strong Soviet guard. The whole scene was photographed by the Soviets, who were engaged in putting together an authentic documentary film of the capture of Berlin. On May 9th, with the Reich surrender complete, Dr. Schreiber was sent with other officers to a much larger prisoner of war camp in Posen, where he stayed until August 12, 1945. A transport of generals to Moscow had been organized. Schreiber said he arrived there on August 29th. The transport was very badly organized, Schreiber said, according to the dossier report. There was a food shortage because the cooks on the transport sold the food on the black market or kept it for themselves. Schreiber's testimony was resplendent with details. All generals were sent to the PW camp number 7027 in Krasnogorsk near Moscow, he recalled. Here, the food tasted wonderful because it came from the United States in cans. Schreiber repeatedly told Wallach how much he loved everything about the United States. On March 12, 1946, Schreiber said he was transferred to the Lubyanka prison in Moscow. Treatment not bad. On March 20th, he claimed to have been interrogated by the Russians for the first time. Subject was the German preparation for biological warfare. Wallach had to have known that this was highly improbable. Schreiber was one of the Third Reich's highest-ranking medical doctors, and he was a major general in the army. On March 20, 1946, he would have been in Soviet custody for 10 months. That this was his first interrogation was absurd. Schreiber told Wallach he was questioned by a lieutenant general named Kabalov for 3 days. Kabalov didn't believe his testimony, Schreiber said, and so he was told, Soviet interrogators are going to use now physical violence to break you and get the whole truth out of you. The next interrogation, recalled Schreiber, took place at 3 o'clock that same morning. I was beaten by a Soviet officer whom he knows as Lieutenant Smirnov. Together with a Colonel Walter Stern, who speaks German without the slightest accent, and who was an excellent interrogator. Schreiber said he withstood 3 weeks of rough interrogation, at which point he finally broke down and wrote the statement which later on was submitted by the Soviet government to the International War Crimes Tribunal in Nuremberg. He was flown from Moscow to Berlin, then down to Nuremberg to testify at the war crimes trial. During one of the flights, Schreiber said his German-speaking Soviet interrogator, Colonel Stern, leaned over and whispered a warning to him. If Schreiber were to go off book and say anything detrimental to the interests of the Soviet Union, he would be hanged on his return to Russia. After testifying at Nuremberg, Schreiber said he was taken back to the Soviet Union, where he and 3 generals were set up in a 2-story country house in Tomelino, 16 miles southeast of Moscow. One of the 3 generals was Field Marshal Friedrich Paulus, the highest-ranking Nazi general to have ever surrendered to the Soviets, which Paulus did during the Battle of Stalingrad. Paulus's own story of the events leading up to his capture and his final communication with Hitler was remarkable. The Soviets had also brought Paulus to testify at Nuremberg. As William Shire explained in The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, The last days of Paulus's command during the battle for Stalingrad were cataclysmic. Paulus, torn between his duty to obey the mad Führer and his obligation to save his own surviving troops from annihilation, appealed to Hitler. Paulus sent an urgent message to the Führer that read, "Troops without ammunition or food. Effective command no longer possible. 18,000 wounded without supplies or dressing or drugs. Further defense senseless. Collapse inevitable. Army requests immediate permission to surrender in order to save lives of remaining troops." But Hitler refused to allow Paulus to surrender. "Surrender is forbidden," Hitler wrote in return. "Sixth Army will hold their positions to the last man and the last round, and by their heroic endurance will make an unforgettable contribution toward the establishment of a defensive front and the salvation of the Western world." Heroic endurance was a euphemism for suicide. Paulus was now supposed to kill himself. Hitler nudged him further in this direction by making Paulus a field marshal in what he hoped would be the last hour of the general's life. There is no record in military history of a German field marshal being taken prisoner, Hitler told Alfred Jodl, who was standing next to him at the time. Instead, at 7:45 the following morning, Field Marshal Paulus surrendered. His last message to Hitler, "The Russians are at the door of our bunker. We are destroying our equipment." He was taken prisoner shortly thereafter. What Paulus left behind was, as described by Scheyer, a terrifying scene. 91,000 German soldiers, including 24 generals, half-starved, frostbitten, many of them wounded, all of them dazed and broken, were hobbling over the ice and snow, clutching their blood-caked blankets over their heads against the 24 degrees below zero cold, toward the dreary, frozen prisoner-of-war camps of Siberia. Of the 91,000 Germans taken prisoner by the Soviets, only 5,000 would come out of the prison camps alive. Paulus was one of them. By 1947, he was living comfortably in this two-story country house with Major General Dr. Schreiber outside Berlin. "Actually," explained Schreiber, "there were a total of 4 former Nazi generals living together under one roof. In addition to Field Marshal Friedrich Paulus, there was Lieutenant General Vincenz Müller, captured outside Minsk in 1944, and General Erich Buschenhagen, captured in eastern Romania in August 1944. "For what purpose?" Wallach asked. Subject, Schreiber, is convinced Lieutenant General Vincenz Müller was ordered by the Soviets to indoctrinate Professor Dr. Schreiber with communistic ideas. Whatever the real reason, Schreiber said he and his fellow generals lived a relatively enjoyable life full of Soviet perks. At one point, General Schreiber and General Buschenhagen were taken to live in Moscow in a nicely furnished private house. Their Soviet handler, with them constantly, acted as a guide and took them to the museum, opera, and to playhouses, stressing the fact that Soviet Russia has a highly developed culture. For Schreiber, the motive was clear. This, too, was, of course, part of the planned indoctrination program, he told Special Agent Wallach. All the while, Schreiber feigned that he was a happy communist. In July 1947, Field Marshal Paulus became sick, and the group was taken to a summer resort, Livadia, on the Crimea. There was no shortage of irony here. This was the same palatial resort at which the Yalta Conference took place in February 1945. The dangerous Lieutenant General Vincenz Müller was with Paulus and Schreiber at the resort. The group stayed through the summer and returned to Moscow by private jet when the summer weather passed. For the next year, the former Nazi generals resided again at the country house in Tomelino, Schreiber said. Only now, they were heavily engaged in anti-fascist courses that the Soviets required them to take. Studying kept the generals occupied until September 7, 1948. That's when Schreiber said he learned that he and 25 other former Nazi generals would be leaving